This episode of Game On with Cody and John is dedicated to the memory of Jack Reuben Vassell.
Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's episode 58 of Game On with Cody and John.
This is Game On with Cody and John, the uncommon podcast for the common gamer. Bringing you the latest and greatest from the world of tabletop gaming, board games, card games, RPGs, and miniatures wargaming. News and discussions on gaming and gamer culture, plus reviews of some of the best games on the market. And now, from the Game On Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, here are Cody Jones and John Richard.
Well, howdy gamers. It is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. We're a podcast about all sorts of tabletop gaming, board games, card games, role-playing games, popcorn, and soda.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's what Cody's got in front of him right now.
Tasty.
Yeah, pretty good.
Tasty.
For coming to you from the beautiful gaming capital of the world, Indianapolis, Indiana, where we got nothing to talk about regarding football.
No, it's just perpetual snow here.
Yeah.
We've got the Super Bowl here coming up. We're going to talk football, yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Packers and Steelers. I really don't care who wins. I don't really like the Steelers very much. So
my boss at work is a big time Packers fan, so it might be in my best interest to root for the Packers.
Bonuses for everyone.
Exactly.
Just wear a cheese head.
She actually went to the Super Bowl in 97 when they went. So wow. She's a hardcore fan. Has season tickets in Lambeau Field.
Yeah, you have to get those willed to you.
Yeah, and that's how she got them. Oh, yeah. She talks about her daughter. You know, well, yeah, she'll get them someday.
Well, anyway. In non-cheesehead related news.
Yes.
What we got?
we're at episode 58.
Uh-huh.
No real milestone there, no. But it's I don't know. Every time we record a new episode, I think, wow, it's one more than it was before. That's pretty cool. We're still doing this.
That's so. How numbers work. Yeah.
We're going to be doing an episode that's somewhat piratey themed.
That's right. We've got two ends of the pirate spectrum, as you were, the yin yar.
Very nice.
Thank you. We have Pirate Flux, the newest edition of Flux from Looney Labs.
Mm-hmm.
And we have Merchants and Marauders, a high seas, you know, piracy and trading game from Z-Man Games.
That's right.
It's the new hotness right now. We're all about that.
Some would say that's the two ends of the spectrum of good and bad. But
yeah.
All you Flux haters out there, don't even listen to this episode.
Just skip ahead.
But we're going to start off with a rundown of what we've been playing. We're going to start that
now.
Well, it's January here in the gaming capital. Not much to do except for sit inside and look at the snow and play a lot of good games. And so we're going to bring you, as always, our rundown of what we've been playing. And Cody, what have you been playing the last couple weeks?
It's been a good couple weeks. Got a lot of games to the table.
Good, because my list is kind of short.
That's how it always is. I'm the cornucopia of gaming.
I know.
And you are the doggy bag.
And I own like four times more games than you do.
That's true.
That's sad.
Mm. Quality, not quantity, my
friend. Okay, please proceed.
I had heard a lot about a card game called Bottle Imp. I believe Z-Man is putting it out now.
Mm-hmm.
I like trick-taking games and / ladder games for, you know, 2 to 4, and Bottle Imp is for 3 to 4 players. And I've got to the table a few times, and I'm not real impressed with it.
Really?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's based off like a Robert Louis Stevenson short story about this bottle imp that if you have it, all of your dreams and your riches and everything you want will come to you. But if you die and you have the bottle imp, then you forfeit your soul.
Ah, so yeah. You have to get rid of it.
So you have to get rid of it. But the trick is you have to get rid of it at a lower price than what you paid for it.
Mm.
And so they work that theme into all the cards that just have numbers on it. And there's a lot of play there. But I don't know. The more I play it, the more I would just prefer to play Haggis or Teach You. And I know they're a little different, but
Yeah. There's
about any other card game I'd rather play. I'm just not real thrilled by it.
Hmm.
Just too bad.
Okay. Speaking of like traditional like trick taking card games and things like that, the Spiel podcast from
mm-hmm.
their most recent episode is about revisiting classics, and they talk about several card games that sort of draw from other. From other games, and one of the ones they talked about that I thought you and I might really like is called Rowboat,
mm-hmm.
and it's like a trick-taking card game with this sort of nautical theme to it, and I think we might want to pick that one up.
Maybe. I've heard middling things on it.
Here. Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I don't know.
So, for those of you who like, a lot of good reviews, of course, check out the Spiel podcast. This particular episode, they even talked about Boo Ray.
Oh, yeah.
Remember the guy who wrote it about Blu-ray? Yeah, so anyway, please proceed.
On the other side of the coin, Pony Express, which I'm currently game sharing for Myriad Games, is getting a lot of play. I've played with a lot of different people, and everyone loves it. A lot of repeat plays. And, oh, let's play it again, you know, immediately after.
Nice. You better pull the trigger on that purchase, or Dan's going to send his SWAT team out here to come and get it from you.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to go ahead and buy it. it's really neat because it's funny. Whenever I get to the shooting the Indians part of it, there's always the same kind of reaction. Like they kind of look at me funny, then they gasp, and then they kind of laugh. So I'm not sure what's going on there.
Okay,
but Pony Express, really fun game. It's I would say it's a party game. You know, it's a kind of nice rolling move there. What else? Kind of zoom through some of this. Zombie Dice, always good. Castle Ravenloft, I hadn't played that in a while.
You got such a long list over there, you're having to like skim through it. Yeah. Oh, I played like 27 games, and oh, let me just go through. Oh, it is. Oh, he's showing it to me. It is a pretty long list. Okay.
It's good.
Yeah, sorry.
Let's see. Got Castle Ravenloft to the table. Been a while for that. That's a good one. I've played a few games of Merchants and Marauders, which we'll talk about later.
Yep.
I got Mystery Express back to the table. I finally picked that up for my collection, and I thought it went over okay. The time element is probably my least favorite because now I have it figured out.
That's how to do it.
It's kind of one of those things. It's like if you don't know how to figure it out, then you're just going to be lost and you're going to get mad at the game. If you have it figured out, then you don't even. It's just an exercise. You know, yeah. You'll figure it out. And, you know, it's just a time waster. So I've seen variants where people are not playing with it, where they're just playing with the four colored cards.
It's funny because that's a game that I figured that it would appeal to people who like Clue. Like it's one of those things you can tell people. Oh, do you like Clue? Yeah, I do. Oh, well, play this. It's even better, you know. But I think it might, in some ways, it takes elements of Clue that people don't like that much and makes it, like the deduction part of it, and makes it even more complex. I really like the game myself, but I'm also, you know, I'm pretty dyed-in-the-wool gamer, so.
Yeah.
So how did it go over with the rest of the group?
It went okay. I think they liked it well enough. I don't know if they were chomping the bit to play it again. But.
Okay.
A game I do want to play again, which may be surprising to some listeners, is Seven Wonders.
No.
Now I played it, if you remember last episode, I played it and just didn't care for it all. I got another play of it in, and it was like night and day. I don't know what was different. It was the same amount of players. I don't know. I came at it with a different attitude, and I found I really liked it.
So. It was also a different time of night. Like we played it, the first time you played it was like 11:30 or something like that.
Yeah, after a 4-hour game of Sid Meier's Civ.
Yeah,
so that may have something to do. So Seven Wonders, I'm starting to see why it's so popular. It'd be fun. I would really like to play a 7-player game of it.
Yeah,
I think that would be a lot of fun.
Now, I made the comment I think after we played that. When I was at BGG Con and we played, it would just seem like this very sort of raucous game with all this, you know, interaction and everything. Boy, the couple times we played, it just seemed so quiet. Like I didn't picture that it would be such a silent game, but that's all it really is, you know, look at your cards, pick a card, pass the cards, look at your cards, pick a card, pass the cards.
Yeah.
You know, that, but no, silence not necessarily bad.
Yeah.
Especially if you're a Euro gamer. Which is what you're turning into.
No. Other games include Alien Frontiers, always a good one.
Oh, yeah.
Don't forget, if you go to clevermojogames.com, you can get your pre-order in for the second printing. It's going to be out in March, I believe.
Mm.
And if you do have that first copy, you can get the new promo card and little scoring rockets for a nominal fee. So
I heard that they're making an online version of Alien Frontiers.
That would be cool.
They've partnered with some company that's going to be doing that. So maybe check out the Alien Frontiers forums on BGG. There's probably some information about that there.
Great game. Played some more Haggis, which we talked about last episode. Still really like it.
Haggis.
I got a chance to try out Cyclades or Cyclades.
Cyclades.
my buddy Dare brought that over. And that was interesting. It was... That seemed like a really good blend of Ameritrash and Euro a little bit because it's kind of, you know, it's got war game elements to it, but it's handled in a very Euro kind of almost bidding style.
What's the theme of that game? I haven't even really looked at it at all.
The best I could think, it's a kind of like a Greek mythology themed game.
Okay.
And you're bidding on, I think, like getting the services of Zeus or Apollo or Athena or, you know, assorted Ares, you know, assorted Greek gods to assist you as you try it. You're trying to build two metropolises or metropoli, I don't know.
Yeah.
And, you know, getting those gods and attacking other people and taking over, that's how you can get buildings to do that.
Oh, so cool.
I think it would be really good with 5. We played with 3, and there's kind of the rules change a little bit based on number of players. That one, I think the more the merrier. I think a 5-player game would get really tricky with the bidding, and I'd play it again. I didn't completely love it, but I'd like to. I'd play it one more time.
Cool.
And then
I'm seeing a change in you, Cody.
Yeah?
I'm seeing a wonderful, wonderful change.
Well, thank you. I'm blossoming.
Oh, my.
The last thing I played was Last Night on Earth, one I hadn't played in a very long time.
Beautiful game.
I finally got to play a scenario that wasn't Die, Zombies, Die. Every time I played, it's just kill 15 zombies, kill 15 zombies. We did the zombie apocalypse scenario where the zombies have to basically, you know, destroy six buildings in town before the sun rises. And it was okay. It probably wasn't my favorite scenario, but it was nice playing the game because that game is dripping with theme. It's not the tightest game out there, but
it's fun.
It evokes theme like nothing else. And of course, we listened to the Last Night on Earth soundtrack.
Fantastic music.
The pinnacle of modern music. And the only other thing was an RPG, which you had a hand in, but we'll talk about that a little later.
Definitely.
That's my rundown.
All right. And he throws it down and you're spent. All right. Well, okay. Well, for me, I have a few things in common with Cody since we played some games together this past couple of weeks. But as far as at home, I've been playing one particular game with my kids that at first had not gone over very well when I first bought it, but now is an absolute hit at my house, and that's the Kids of Carcassonne.
Oh.
Yeah. And so now I know you're not a fan of Carcassonne. Mm-hmm. Neither is my wife. Neither is just about any person that I've encountered in my gaming. It seems like everybody, I have a copy of the Hunters and Gatherers version, but it never gets played because nobody likes it, even though I really like it. Anyway, the Kids of Carcassonne is sort of a different version of the game that's really catered for smaller kids in that the goal is that you're just trying to get rid of the meeples that you have. Everybody has eight meeples. And you know, same as regular Carcassonne, your turn is to take and turn over a tile and then find a place to put it. It's much more simple as far as, you know, what's on the tiles. But in addition to the roads and, you know, little meadows and stuff that are on the tile, there's also little pictures of little children that are different colors, like different colored outfits. And the idea is that you're trying to complete roads. Roads are really the only thing that you're caring about in this game, other than, you know, not like farms and, you know, all the forests and things in the other game. So you're just caring about roads. When you complete a road, then you look at that road and see all of the little children that are on the road there, and then you will place meeples of your color onto the appropriate, you know, colored children. And so that means that if you complete a road, you might earn points for yourself, but you also might earn points for other people. So you're trying to place your tile in a way that's going to get you the opportunity to place your meeple down and not other people. So real, it's kind of simple strategy, but it's really cool to see my 7-year-old really make some good strategic choices about where to put those tiles. And even my 4-year-old, we played a big 4-player game of it where, well, we played, I guess, a 5-player game where Aaron and I were like teammates, basically. She said, Daddy, you're in charge of the meeples and I'm in charge of the tiles. Like, okay. You place the tiles down, I'll put the meeples down. And we were in almost like in last place, and we got down to the very last tile. And so it's whoever the first person is to get rid of all their meeples is the winner. Unless you put all the tiles down, then it's whoever has the fewest number is the winner. We had like 5 meeples left. Everybody else had 3 or less. And had been building this road with like 3 or 4, you know, of our color on there. And the very last tile completed that road, and we put 5 meeples down in one turn. And I did not tell Erin where to put the tile at all. She figured it all out on her own. And so it was like this big triumphant. Everybody laughed, and Erin gave them high fives and everything. So it was a really cool experience there. So
they're getting close.
Yeah. So if you have kids that are in that sort of 4 to 8, 4 to 9 sort of range, and maybe when you get towards about 9, that's going to, well, yeah, 8 or 9, that's going to be probably a little bit too old for them. But it's a real good entry to that style of game, to a tile laying game. So Kids of Carcassonne, big winner. Again, like Cody said, I played 7 Wonders, played some Merchants and Marauders, played some Pirate Flux, which we're going to be talking about a little bit later. And excuse me, got a little congestion.
It is that time.
A little bit of the winner. That's
what the listeners like to hear.
The winner Kazute there. But I had a chance to go and play the game Formula D, which I hadn't really played since last summer at the Spiel annual tournament. And really, the Spiel's annual tournament is the main time that I get to play Formula D, even though I do own a copy of it. It doesn't get out very often. And the style of that tournament is one where the races are very, very quick. They're timed races, so you're only playing for like 7 or 8 minutes, and then, you know, you see where everybody's landed, and then you move on to the next table. So I hadn't really played a full game of Formula D before, and so I was invited over by a gaming friend of mine who had gotten five folks together. And so we each had two cars, so it filled up the 10 cars on the track. And we played a three-lap race.
Oh, wow.
It took like 3.5 hours to play this. We were also talking and just getting caught up and everything. So, you know, it was a really slow-paced game anyway, having a good time. But what I found was that when you have that three-lap race, you have to be very conservative with what you do because, you know, your tires and your brakes will blow out really quickly. And I didn't, we didn't really do that at first. And so all of us had a car blown up by the end of the first lap.
Yeah, you're used to an 8-minute race where you just don't care. You know, you're just going as fast as you can.
And then if your car blows up, who cares? Because you get a new car the next board. So it was a very different style of race, but it ended up with a new guy that I'd met named Dan, who won the game on the very last die roll. I was in second place. So that is a great game. And when you start playing with more of the rules, because there's rules for like, body damage, of course, collision with other cars. There's, you know, you can exert your car and, take engine damage. There's even like suspension damage if you happen to drive over debris and stuff like that. I'd never played with some of those more advanced rules, and that made it a whole lot of fun. So we should pull that out sometime when we have like a party or something.
Definitely. It reminds me of another racing game that I like, the Great Space Race, put out by Kenzer and Company 5-6 years ago. It's kind of... It's a racing game in space, no less.
Really?
And but it's one of those kind of like almost death race things where, you know, you're laying down mines and you're shooting. It's real random.
Mario Kart the game,
yeah, exactly. More Mario Kart in space. But that one, the downside is that one. Yeah, that one takes, you know, 3 hours to play a full game. But we should have a racing day.
That'd be cool. Yeah, a good little themey thing there. One other game that I had picked up on recommendation of another podcast, actually, of Eric Summer of the Dice Tower, a little two-player game from, Cosmos? Z-Man? I think it's Z-Man that's distributing it, called Perry Rodan, The Cosmic League.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a pick-up-and-deliver game sort of set in space. I didn't even know this. I had to go look it up. I guess Perry Rodan is this German science fiction series. It's been around for like 50 years, and it's the longest running. I don't know if it's like comic books or books or something like that, but it's real popular in Europe, I guess. And I'd never really heard of it. And so it's like a pick-up and deliver game. It's a two-player game, and the box is a small box. It comes with some really nice cardboard components and some decks of cards and little cardboard standees for things. And I thought it was a lot of fun. Actually, you had a chance. I taught you and Kaylin how to play that game. And what'd you think of it?
I thought it was good. It was, I didn't really get the Perry Rodan part of it, but it was an enjoyable little pick up and deliver game. It was tense. I came from way behind and ended up winning, so
yeah.
I liked it even more. So.
Yeah, that's always good to see when that happens to Cody, because he usually gets up and goes, yeah! So, much to his wife's chagrin.
Yes. I just get the look. I'm used to it.
Yeah. But, you know, really, other than staring longingly at my Avatar of Menoth miniature and not actually getting it put together yet.
Come on now.
I know. That's about all I've been doing for gaming. So that's the rundown.
Yeah. Well, there is the one thing that I mentioned. Your crowning achievement, I think, in the rundown.
Well, my the role-playing game?
Uh-huh.
Rogue Trader. That's right. Do you want to talk about that?
Let's do it. All right, so it was I had a proud papa moment, you know, in gaming.
A proud papa moment.
Yes,
have no children.
I have no progeny. No.
Okay.
John completed his first little mini campaign as a game master, and he did it with the Rogue Trader system.
I did.
Set in the dark and
the grim far future.
There's only war.
That's right.
From what I hear, and so we're going to give you kind of a shakedown. You know, this is something we talked about for a while. You know, John,
a shakedown.
I don't know.
I'm not sure how to do that.
We're going to talk about John's GMing experience, his first time, what he liked, what he didn't like. So tell us.
Okay.
Go.
So I really enjoyed it. I thought that being a GM was a lot of fun. And I can see why Cody gets such a kick out of doing it. And it was very fun crafting the story. Now, I used the adventure that's in the back of the Rogue Trader book that just comes with the rule book called Into the Maw. And, I won't go into the details of the story in case you happen to run it yourself at some point. But the basic idea is that you're kind of on a treasure hunt looking for a treasure ship. I don't think it's giving away too much to say that.
Spoiler.
But anyway, so you encounter a whole bunch of different stuff, and there's some slight twists and turns. But what I found was that And one of the cool things about role-playing games is that there were more twists and turns in the game than I expected that there would be because of what the players decided to do. And that's, I mean, that's just one of the earmarks of a really good role-playing game is just the ability for things just to veer off course. And that was one of the things I was the most worried about. I think I expressed it on the show, is that I'm afraid of not knowing the rules or not knowing what to do if something gets off the rails. And what I found was kind of the opposite. I almost found that the adventure that I was using almost was too streamlined. It's like I found myself trying to force the players back onto the path instead of just going with it, because I was just afraid that if they got too far off the path, then I wouldn't know what to do.
Right.
But if I had written my own adventure, then I could just do it a lot more on the fly, and I wouldn't feel like I would have to constantly be pulling it back in.
Yeah, I mean, it's good for new GMs to have a little bit of a framework, but you'll find as you GM more that you just prefer to do your own stuff, because then you know it cold, and if the party wanders, then you can kind of wander with them and recraft the story as they go.
Right, right. And, so the ending of the story went very differently than I expected that it would, just due to some interesting decisions that the player decided to make. It was a bit of a Pyrrhic victory, actually. Yeah. And one of my favorite parts is there's a section in the story where you're fighting a group of bad guys, and there's a way sort of in the book that it says that this fight is supposed to go, and Cody's character, which happened to be this kind of Arlie Ermey,
outstander,
sergeant character, it's like, all right, what are you going to do? And he's like, oh, I'm gonna step over to the side here and pull out my missile launcher and fire a missile into the crowd. Like, what?
Oh,
that wasn't in the book. Fire a missile into the crowd. Okay, so I had to go look up all the missile rules. I'm like, I didn't know we could do that. So, but that's what makes it just a blast.
Now, what did you think of the system in general, the crunchy bits?
Okay, well, so like I said, GMing is fun. Role playing games are fun. Board gamers, listen to the show. If you haven't done a role playing game, you need to try one at a con or something like that, because it's really a lot of fun. But the Rogue Trader system. Well, let me say it this way. The Rogue Trader world is phenomenal. I mean, I think it's very, very cool. I think it's the backstory and the fluff that goes along with it. Of course, it's the 40K world that's been around for many, many years, and lots of different variants and stories being told out of that world. So the idea of Rogue Trader, I really like. And, the idea of this ship being able to travel and has this warrant of trade, and it's a kind of a high powered game because everybody's sort of rich and powerful.
Right.
You're not like the little minions.
You're not a level one fighter.
Right. Right. Even the level one people in this game are pretty powerful and very well respected. But having said that, I think the rules for this game are, I think they're just a little bit overly complex for what it's trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
I found myself, it could be just also cause I'm just a new GM, that I found myself having to look up stuff a whole lot, and just because it wasn't intuitive, the bonuses for certain things or what die roll you need to make or what skill you need to use. It just was very, very much a slog, especially things like starship combat. I really think that chapter of the book was written really poorly.
Yeah.
And so that made it difficult because we had like two or three different pieces of starship combat in the game, and that just slowed it down really badly.
Yeah, I wasn't real impressed with the system. Like you said, the world and the fluff was neat, but it was a really complex system, and it's kind of funny. I found the more I've GM'd, I've been role-playing for a while now, and it's just like I'm starting to prefer the more rules-like systems as I go. Mm. Like even, 4E and Pathfinder, I still like playing it, but that's as crunchy as I want to get. I don't want to do any more rules than that. I prefer more the, kind of like the older versions of D&D that have simpler rules, ubiquity games like Hollow Earth Expedition, and then you have Savage World, stuff like that. I'm finding that's the games I'm gravitating to because it's easier to tell the story. Because
yeah.
I really saw a moment where, you were really being diligent about doing things by the book, and then you just kind of realized, oh, we're doing this for the story. And then it's like you turn that corner, and then you're like, well, I can adjudicate this as I want. It was fair. It was off the cuff, but it worked, and it pushed the story along versus slogging through a combat that we didn't really need to do.
Yeah.
So kudos to you.
Well, thank you. Yeah. And that's what I sort of have found is that when you're able to kind of let go of the stickiness of the rules, that makes it a lot more fun. We can give you an example here just of the complexity, because some of you might who have played role-playing games and maybe know this game would say, oh, this isn't complex. It's a percentile-based system. But take like a combat in D&D. you know, D&D, you want to roll to hit somebody with your sword or something like that. You're gonna have a bonus for your sword, and so you'll and so you'll roll your D20.
D20 add your modifiers compared to a target number.
That's the core mechanic. Yep. D20 add your modifiers compared to the mechanic. What you just said.
The target number.
The target number. In Rogue Trader, it's basically that you have a weapon skill or whatever kind of skill you're going to roll, and you roll 2d10, which will be for a percentile of 100, and you have to roll under a particular number, and then that's a success. But when you hit somebody, let's say with a gun, you roll your ballistic skill to see if you hit them with a gun. Okay, so then let's say you pass that. Okay, well now you have to roll your damage, which is based upon your gun. So it might be 2d10 plus 2 is your gun. And so you roll that damage. Okay, then you have to roll 2d10 again and consult a chart to determine where the bullet hit. And so then after you've seen that, then you have to go and look at that character's armor. And there's not just one armor value. There's an armor for every part of their body. So there's left arm, right arm, left leg, right leg, body, and head. And so then if you hit them in the left leg, well, now you're having to look and see what is the armor in that. Then you take the damage and you subtract their toughness bonus, which is the tens place of their toughness number, and then also subtract the armor, and then whatever number is left over, that's the amount of wounds that the person takes. And so then they have that wasn't complex enough, then, unlike a game where you have 20 wounds and then when you get down to zero, you're dead. In this game, if you get down past 20 wounds, then you have literally 8 pages of charts in the book that are critical damage. So then if you take on any more damage after that, then you're basically playing a gambling game, more or less, of is this damage going to kill you or not? And some of that's kind of comical because, you roll really badly and it has comical text you are burnt to a cinder or something like that.
And I think that mechanic, where after, below zero, you're just kind of gambling. I think that's cool. But the way they did it with all these charts, it's just
tiresome. Yeah, you had to have the book in front of you to do it, unless you just wanted to make up your own critical charts yourself and have them in a notebook or something. But so for me, you can sort of see that's just a little overly complex, because then I feel like I can't tell the story that quickly. I just want to know, did it hit? And then, I can, as a GM, I can say that you got hit in the left leg or something, if it's just an overall measure of how wounded you are.
Yeah.
I
think one thing that would have also helped is none of us were that familiar with the 40K world. Some of us had a passing familiarity. That may have helped a little bit, but still the rules were...
What ended up happening is everything devolved to Star Trek. Yeah. It's like we all knew Star Trek. So when we're doing ship combat or the ships exploring in the system, then it sort of became well, do we have sensors? Can we scan it with our sensors? Is there a shuttlecraft somewhere on the ship? And I'm just like, I don't even know what it's called. So we'll just call it a shuttlecraft. So, everything just sort of became sort of variation on Star Trek.
It was fun.
Yeah. I had a really good time though. We're actually going to continue our group with the same players. I think they did. Everyone seemed to really enjoy it.
Yeah, it was a good group.
But we're going to go with a different system. So going forward, the illustrious Cody is going to be our GM, and we're going to be running a game of Hollow, or you're going to be running a game of Hollow Earth Expedition.
Yep, the old standby.
Oh yeah,
love that one. And putting out a plug for Exile Games. They put out Hollow Earth Expedition. You can check out their stuff at exilegames.com, and they have a couple source books out. But the neat thing they've come out with is two kind of standalone adventures, which they really haven't released before. One is called Miracle Stone of the Amazon, which is just a standard pulp adventure. I'm going to be running that at HoosierCon in March.
Nice.
And then another one is Frozen City of Terror, which is more kind of like a Cthulhu mythos. It's got kind of a horror, pulp horror theme to it. I playtested that back in Origins 2009, my first playtester credit on a module.
Oh, very
cool.
And
I'm listed as Cody Jakes.
Cody Jakes? Did you get it wrong, or did you say that you wanted it that way?
No, they got it wrong.
Oh, okay.
No, they're going to fix it the next
edition. I thought you were like, list me as Cody Jakes, please. That's my no.
But,
alias.
But definitely, especially if you're new to RPGs, Ubiquity and Hollow Earth Expedition is a great game to go with. So exilegames.com. I love those guys over there. I got to give them a free plug.
All right. Well, I concur with that. All right. So that was the role-playing part, and we'll go from role-playing to something completely different.
If a pirate says,
do you know Captain Hook?
Always tell him no.
If a pirate says,
can I have a cup of tea?
Always tell him no.
If a pirate says,
Can you clean me ship?
All right, well, it's time to talk about the first of our two pirate-themed games that we're going to discuss. Yar, indeed. This one is Pirate Flux by our buddies at Looney Labs. Now, as we mentioned earlier, Flux haters, just fast forward. Because really, it's just Flux with a pirate theme. There's a few. It's not just Flux. There's a few new additions, but you know they do a good job of theming their games. And of all the themes I've played, this is probably one of my favorite ones. I'm kind of a vanilla Flux guy.
Yeah.
But this one was a lot of fun to play. And John's going to tell you what's a little different about this version of Flux.
Well, first of all, like what you said, there are the different themes of Flux, and you know, pirates being kind of a fun theme. I think that's been a big knock on the Flux games is that, oh, it's the same game and they just paste a theme onto it. Ordinarily, I would agree with something like that because you take a game like Munchkin and you throw another theme on it and you kind of get the eye roll there. Yeah. You know? With Flux, I think it's almost a little bit different because Munchkin is a game that it's all kind of about inside jokes. You know, it's like, you know, the Munchkin's all about role-playing game inside jokes. If you don't know anything about role-playing games, the game's not going to make much sense, you know. And with Flux, I feel like with all these themes, it's not as much sort of in jokes. It's almost like it's a lot. I think it casts a broader net, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, just generic pirate stuff is not something that's exclusive to just gamers or even, you know, geeks in general. You know, anybody who's ever watched Johnny Depp play Jack Sparrow in Pirates of the Caribbean knows pirates.
Yeah, it's almost like I'm starting to realize that maybe you're not, you know, if you're a Flux fan, you're not expected to pick up every one, although they'd probably love you to, you know, yes. Some more money in their till. But, you know, it's you kind of go with the theme that you like. I don't really, you know, Martian Flux is fine. It's Flux, you know, if you like it or you don't. But the Martian theme doesn't do a whole lot for me.
Yeah.
So I'll play Monty Python or I'll play Zombie Flux before I would play that. So I don't know. It's almost like they've got this system out there and it's kind of like, well, you know, pick the flavor you like. It's going to play pretty similar, but you know, it's dressed differently.
Yeah. And I think it's a great game to pull out when you have a themed game night, you know? So like, you know, we're going to be talking about Merchants and Marauders later, which is a big kind of big meaty long game, but what a great way to start a pirate themed game night with a little game of Pirate Flux, you know, or if you're having, you know, some, like if you're watching alien movies on TV or something like that, play a game of Martian Flux. I mean, it's something you can just plug in. Once you know the system, you know, like Cody said, you can just plug it into whatever theme you know you're interested in. So the pirate game, Pirate Flux, is, you know, all of the cards are piratey themed, and all the keepers are, you know, things like
the captain's hat, my favorite,
the captain's hat, right? Which you know, as long as you have the captain's hat, all the other players have to call you captain, and you know, things like pieces of eight and a sloop and a parrot and all this kind of stuff as your keepers. For those of you who aren't familiar with Flux, I mean, it's real simple. You start off with the basic rules of the game, which are draw one, play one. You start off with three cards, and you don't really know what the goal of the game is until someone plays a pink goal card, which is going to usually involves having a certain combination of keepers on in front of you. And the keepers are just, you know, cards that when on your turn you can play one of them in front of you. There are lots of action cards, these blue cards that can cause all the cards to get shuffled up, and they just do various things to mess with the cards, allow you to draw more cards or less cards. There are also new rules that can be played, which will change up those initial rules of draw one, play one. It could be draw two, play all, or it could be you have a hand limit of three or something like that. So all these, you know, there's a lot of chaos in the game, a lot of luck involved. And, you know, the game can go anywhere from 5 minutes to 2 hours if people are...
Well, no.
No, but 5 to 30 minutes probably, yeah, for a game. And so one new addition to the Pirate Flux game is this idea of the surprise card. Now, something that hasn't been available in previous versions of Flux is the ability to play out of turn. Like, you always have to do
things. And people have been asking for this for a while, yeah, for Flux.
So you always have to do things on your turn. These purple cards called surprise cards will allow you to either play it on your turn to do a certain thing, or you can play it out of turn as sort of an interrupt. And one, for example, here I have from Pirate Flux is called That Be Mine. It says that out of turn, when another player plays a keeper, it goes in front of you instead of them, possibly preventing their victory. And then during your turn, you can use it to steal another player's keeper and put it in front of you. So that adds, I think, a nice little extra flavor to the game to be able to sort of you know, grab things from other people. So there's also a new rule that's involved called Plunder, which will allow you to take cards from other people. It says that once per turn, you can steal any keeper another player has on the table and put it in front of you. So that's something that's real kind of a exclusive to the piratey theme there. So it's Flux. And if you like Flux, then I think, you know, you're going to like Pirate Flux. And if you like the pirate theme, that's a, it's a, it's a good one to pick up.
I think it's their best theme in since Zombie Flux.
Yeah.
I really, really like it.
Stoner Flux is pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
That might be my favorite. I don't know. Anyway, what can I say?
Yeah.
But the if you don't like Flux, this is not the game that will make you like Flux.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's I think retails for $15 or $20.
Yeah, thereabouts. Like, yeah.
Yep. And nice little box and everything. It's a good game. So we love Looney Labs here at Game On with Cody and John. And so,
especially the Looney Pyramids.
Yes.
Big fan.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I know you're okay.
But, yeah, this is another great version of Flux. So, Yar and
Yo-ho.
Shiver Me Timbers.
I will shiver them. All right, well, it's time for the Game On Inbox, where we open the inbox to hear you, the listener's voice. Well,
we have no voicemails this time.
No voicemails for this episode.
We will imitate your voice.
Yeah. Oh, I've got it. But we have a lot of good letters. But first, we want to remind you all of the Game On Game Night, the first occurrence of which is going to be coming up very soon. And John, give us the details.
That's right. Well, hopefully, if this episode is released when I hope it's going to be released,
you and me both, buddy.
Cody rolls his eyes at John, the slow editor. But it's the very first meeting is going to be Tuesday, February the 1st. And so this is for all local Game On listeners and folks who are interested in driving to Indianapolis. It's going to be in Avon, Indiana on the west side. And it's going to be at the Avon United Methodist Church. And it'll be in sort of the lower level of the church there. So you can just park and go in, and I'm sure you'll find it. And so the idea is that we want to just create sort of a local game group for playing board games twice a month. Listener to the show and Board Game Geek member and local guy, Sean Johnson, contacted us, and we're kind of partnering with him. He's a pastor at this Avon United Methodist Church, and he's able to kind of reserve the space for us. We really do appreciate that. And the idea is we just want to open the doors up twice a month, first and third Tuesday night from 6:30 to 9:30 at night. Just to bring games, you know, and if we have three people, great. If we have 50 people, great. We'll have the space and the tables to do it, and just to bring what you love to play. And so if you are interested in getting like a map or directions or anything like that, you can definitely email us at the Game On Inbox.
That's gameoninbox@gmail.com. And a few of you already have.
That's right. Yeah. And that's been great. But you can also, Cody, I think, is going to do a little bit of web magic.
Yep.
Tell them about that.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be, you go to gameonpodcast.com. I was mid-popcorn.
I'm sorry, you're in the middle of popcorn there.
You go to gameonpodcast.com, and there'll be a link there for all of the information. It'll just be a standing link. So if you forget what we said here, you can go there, get the map, get the info, and come and play some games with us.
That's right. So I think it should be really a lot of fun. I actually got a phone call from Jeremy Salinas, who's known as a Draken Strike on Board Game Geek. He's a local guy here who's done some amazing high definition game review videos on Board Game Geek.
Yeah, and, pretty slick.
Yeah, he said he'll probably be able to show up and hopefully bring some games and some friends. So looking forward to that. So let's move on to some emails in the Game On Inbox. And Cody, hit us with one.
Hit us with one? The first email comes from...
Lay it down. Smack it up. I don't know.
Mr. Hans Cummings. He's a local listener. He says, greetings. I was listening to episode 57 this morning, and I noticed one of you, that'd be me, mentioned getting interested again in older RPG systems like AD&D, and near the end of the show, you guys were talking about conventions. Have you heard of GaryCon? GaryCon.com. It's a small convention in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, dedicated to old-school gaming in the memory of Gary Gygax. If it's not in the budget to go up there this year, the convention runs March 25th through 27th. You might want to keep it in mind for next year. Open board gaming goes on the entire convention, and there are a bunch of events ranging from OD&D, AD&D, Metamorphosis Alpha, Wargaming, etc. There are a couple of vendors, but by and large, it is a convention for gaming and only gaming. Sounds a lot like HoosierCon.
Yeah, yeah.
But
what is OD&D?
It's original D&D.
Oh,
like,
gotcha.
Like if you play just the white box stuff, the basic set.
Oh, okay.
That's OD&D. Yeah, I've heard of this, and there's actually a guy who writes a blog that I really like reading called Grognardia.
Ooh.
It's about kind of the old D&D stuff. They're getting something together in Toronto as well. I'm not sure when that's going to be, but this would be fun to go to. Once they finish the Gary Gygax statue up in Lake Geneva. I'd like to go take a pilgrimage and, you know, rub the dice on the statue and just geek out and make a fun weekend of it.
We should make a geek pilgrimage, go up there, and then keep driving and go up to Roseville, Minnesota to the Fantasy Flight Event Center. We can make a whole long weekend out of it.
That'd be fun, yeah. So thanks for the email, Hans.
Yeah. All right, well, so our next email is from Anthony Salvaggio, and he says, really love the show. Just listened to the most recent episode and your discussion of MVP and Myriad. We haven't really mentioned our sponsor very much.
Yeah, this will be our penance because I think this says it all.
Okay. He says, just wanted to add my endorsement of the MVP program. Because of Dan's great service, I received Seven Wonders and Alien Frontiers. It is worth paying MSRP to support this. There are other bonuses as well. This month, Dan even sent some candy for the kids. And so, Anthony, thanks so much for writing us in about that. And, you know, we can't say enough about our great sponsor, Myriad Games, who sponsors our show on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. And you can check them out at myriadgames.com. But the MVP membership, it's a really good deal, even if you don't live in New Hampshire. And the idea is that you have a certain amount of money that you know will be withdrawn from your card or your account or PayPal or whatever every month, and that is store credit at Myriad Games. He's got lots of bonuses depending on what level of Myriad membership you have.
Yeah, and you can trade in your games and get a nice bonus depending on your MVP level.
That's right. I actually just had a large stack of games that I'm just not playing anymore that I sent a list to Dan and said, hey, could you kind of appraise like half price books? Like, could you appraise these? And he sent me back.
Although
said,
you'll actually get a decent deal.
That's true. Yeah. And he, you know, quoted me a price for the games in Myriad money. And also because of our MVP membership, I get some bonus Myriad money for doing a trade. So I'm going to be boxing those games up this week and sending them up and more Myriad money to play with when those new games come out.
That's right. So check out myriadgames.com and second to none service. You can't get it better anywhere else.
Dan is the man.
That's right. We have an email from a friend of the show, Corey Gerleman from Des Moines, Iowa. Mm-hmm. He was the winner of the Dragon Age RPG contest, and he writes regarding that.
Okay.
He says, hey, Cody and John, thanks again for the free copy of Dragon Age.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. I've read through the player's guide and everything in the GM guide except the pre-build adventure, and I'm very excited to give it a go. My dilemma, however, is this. Our game group has been discussing which RPG to start up with. To start up with the idea of doing something small to get going, as many of the gamers haven't run an RPG in years. Sounds like a perfect fit for Dragon Age. However, I'm the RPG newbie in the group, and the experienced ones don't have any experience with the Dragon Age system. While I'd be happy to lend my books out for people to read, I feel like I'm treading unfamiliar waters and I'm hesitant in putting it forth. The main reason is the guys in the group have years or decades of experience in such gaming, have countless different options they've thrown out. So I'm torn whether I should just go along with whatever they see fit for us newbies to see how something is run from start to finish or however long that would be, or trying to push Dragon Age, which interests me the most, as I actually own it and it's my only point of reference for the tabletop RPG world. And to summarize the rest of the email, you know, he talks about different time frames and you know, how often the group will meet. And I say go for it. I
was going to say the same thing.
Yeah.
Yep. Be the GM and go for it.
Yeah. Especially if these guys haven't played in a while. You know, your style is going to be different anyway. So even watching a campaign from start to finish or however it was, you know, you're going to run it a little differently. So I would say just boldly step out there and run it and you're going to do a great job.
Yeah. I mean, if you feel intimidated by these friends of yours, like if you think that they're going to kind of strong arm you and be a jerk about it, then, you know, maybe that requires a conversation on your part with them. But no, I'd say that it's probably a really good idea to do it that way. As a matter of fact, the very first RPG campaign I ever played in, which was a Dungeons & Dragons 3.5 campaign, was a new GM who had never GM'd before, saying, you know, bringing several people together to play and said, I just want to, you know, kind of like what I just did, you know. But except for me, everybody at the table was an extremely experienced player and an experienced GM. And he brought them together like that on purpose because he wanted to be able to rely on them for some help. And I think if you get the right folks with the right personalities that, you know, and the right attitudes, that can be really great because then when you do get stuck, you know, they're in a very positive way kind of nudging you on and helping you out with your GMing rather than being kind of adversarial about it. So
yeah,
it could be a real positive thing.
The fact you're willing to GM and you have the materials and you're ready to go, you're halfway there. So
yeah,
definitely just step out and run it. And we're real excited to hear how you like the game and how your first time GMing experience, you know, parallels with John's and what tips you might have. So keep fighting the good fight and let us know how it goes.
Yeah. Thanks for writing. All right, and so we have an email from Nathan Clark from New Zealand. Now, you might remember about a year or so ago, we had an all-out war over the media channels here between Australian and Kiwi listeners. Mm-hmm. And Nathan was right in the fray there, if I remember right. And he writes, "Hi, Cody and John. I'm a longtime listener to your show and have just finished listening to episode 57. I have two 2011 gaming resolutions. The first is to organize more gaming nights based on games that I enjoy and with like-minded gamers. In the past, I've organized game nights and tried to accommodate my wife and other non-gamers with games that I would not ordinarily choose to play. I'm now at the point where I just want to play games that I enjoy with other gamers who are also keen to play. I'm a little tired of trying to convince non-gamers to play games, as I often end up playing games that I'm not so keen on, or they end up not enjoying a game that I think is brilliant. My favorite game by far is Battlestar Galactica, followed by Dominion."
Good taste.
Good man.
Good taste.
And just to speak to that for a second, I mean, that's, I think a lot of what this game night that we just mentioned, for, you know, the local game night is all about, is sort of feeling the same way about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. About, you know, it's not wanting to always, every time you bring people with their wives and their, or their boyfriends and girlfriends and their kids and all that kind of stuff, it just turns into a party game night. It's just the way,
or Ticket to Ride at the heaviest.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So good man. My second resolution is to continue to refine my gaming preferences. I haven't always found this easy, and in 2010, I purchased a number of games that I played a few times and then decided they were not the games for me, despite thoroughly researching my purchases, and always cognizant of the Jones theory, of course.
Of course.
I tend to enjoy heavily themed Ameritrash-style games, and with that in mind, I have an eye on Descent as my next purchase. I played D&D and HeroScape as a kid, and think I would enjoy Descent with other gamers who enjoy a bit of role-playing and using their imaginations. Would love to hear your thoughts on Descent. Would this be considered a link between board games and RPGs? Love the show and look forward to the next episode.
Cody? I would say yes, yes, but with the caveat that if you... I'm assuming you're not currently or planning to do any sort of RPG campaign like D&D or any other fantasy thing. Because if you're going to do that, just do that.
Yeah.
Because you won't play both. But if you're not and you just want something that's kind of, you know, it's mostly board games, got some RPG elements, especially with Road to Legend or Sea of Blood, Descent's going to be a great pick for you. I think it's going to be right up your alley. And if you don't really want to commit to a full RPG campaign and thick rule books, I think Descent's the second best thing and you'll have a lot of fun with it.
I completely agree.
All right.
Says the guy who just sold his copy of Descent.
I play RPGs.
Well, no, that makes sense. Yeah.
And I follow my own advice.
That's
see.
Right. Yeah.
I think that wraps up the Game On inbox.
Is there any way that you couldn't be Jones Theory compliant? I was just thinking, you developed the Jones Theory.
I guess I could. I mean, I look at my collection now. I think I'm compliant.
I'm gonna say is that if you ever change, then it'll just be the new Jones Theory, right?
Yes, exactly.
Cody Jones is always Jones Theory compliant.
Well, that's right.
Well, anyway, we really do appreciate all the folks that wrote in, and we always would encourage you to give us feedback, tell us what you like and don't like, and just interact with us about what we've talked about on the show. You can always reach us at the Game On Inbox.
That's gameoninbox@gmail.com.
That's right. Or you can call the Game On Hotline 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year this year.
Madge is standing by to take your call.
That's right. Yeah. Give Game On a call. It's 4138 Game On. So we've said before on the show that we are both gamers that love theme.
Mm-hmm.
Rich themes, heavy themes, you know, just dripping with
creamy themes.
Cream, like double stuffed Oreo themes,
oh my.
Right? And so we're going to be talking today about Merchants and Marauders, which is a new pirate-themed game from some...
Z-Man?
Well, Z-Man in the United States. It was released by somebody else, I think, initially. Good research on with Game
That's
On.
That's right.
So Merchants and Marauders is a game about... piracy.
Yes. Or legitimate trading.
Legitimate trading in the Caribbean. And this game was designed by Christian Markison and Casper Agard. My apologies for any mispronunciation there. And so this game is for 2 to 4 players, and it plays in about, I think that it says in the rules, about 3 hours. And mm-hmm. I think that a better way to say it is it's about 45 minutes per player.
That's about right.
And so, you know, and of course, a little bit more if you have to teach the rules of the game. And so in this game, what you're going to be doing is you play either a marauding pirate mm-hmm. or a good God-fearing merchant. A
completely legitimate merchant.
That's right. Or really, I guess what it's, you sort of start off
completely
neutral.
Legitimate.
You can start off legitimate, and it's only if you decide to do dastardly things do you become a pirate. But and you know, you're trying to get glory points. The object of the game is to win, and the way that you win is by being the first person to obtain 10 glory points. And there's several different ways that you can do this, and some of them are very law-abiding, legitimate ways, and some of them aren't. So, you know, for example, one of the things that you can do is in the game you're going to be going around and getting cargo cards, which are different kinds of goods. If you're able to sell three or more of these cards into a port where those goods are considered in demand, well, then that's going to get you a glory point. So it's things like that. If you defeat another player, sink their ship and attack them and sink their ship.
A merchant would never stoop to such barbarity.
No, but if you took a wrong turn, you know, when you got in there with the wrong crowd, you know, down at the tavern, and all of a sudden you became a pirate, then if you defeat another player, then that's going to get you a glory point as well. There's also kind of an interesting mechanic where as you're going around the board here, you're going to have the opportunity to get gold, and for every 10 pieces of gold, you can get one glory point
that you stash.
Right, but you have to go back to your own home port and stash that gold. And in a 10-point game, up to 5 points of that can be stashed gold. So, and the nice thing is that the game comes with these little three-dimensional treasure chests. Mm-hmm.
Completely unnecessary.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
But fantastic.
Just for looks, you know. There are these three-dimensional things. They kind of reminded me of in Cleopatra and the Society of Architects, mm-hmm. the pyramids that you put the corruption tokens in. And you can stash your gold in those. So the map of the board is going to look just like it's a map of the Caribbean Sea and, mm-hmm. you know, kind of going up to the Bahamas and then down into sort of the northern part of South America.
It reminded me a lot of the Sid Meier's Pirates computer games, both old one and the remake they did about 5 or 6 years ago.
Which you said is pretty good, right?
Oh, yeah. It's one of my favorite games. It's real light, but this game, this almost could be Sid Meier's Pirates the board game, and in a good way. I mean, it evokes the same feel, and you're doing a lot of the same stuff.
Yeah.
So it was really cool.
And so you're going to start off with a player board, and you'll have a ship of some kind. And there's several different ships in the game, but when you start off, you can either have a sloop or a fleet. And the fleet is a ship that's going to be kind of a slower maneuverability ship, but it has a larger cargo bay. If, for example, you wanted to be a good law-abiding merchant, you would need a cargo hold for that.
No, of course.
Yeah. Whereas the sloop is a smaller, faster ship, highly maneuverable, but not much room for cargo. Plenty of room for gold,
right?
But not much room for cargo. So if you wanted to perhaps go in that direction, then you might want to choose the sloop. You're also going to select a captain card. And I'll go ahead and say up front, the artwork and components in this game are just absolutely top-notch. Yep. Just some of the best I've seen in a game in quite a while. Just very rich colors in the rule book and also in the just on the cards.
Good attention to detail everywhere.
Yeah, and so there's like quite a number of captain cards in the game, and you may go through more than one captain, so don't get too attached to your captain. But the artwork on those is very good. There are four nations in the game. There's the French, the Spanish, the English, and the Dutch. And so the particular captain that you select might be from one of those nations, and he'll have a kind of a starting port. So after you select your captain's card and your ship, you kind of get everything all set up. Your ship is going to have stats, which are tracked by these little cubes on your player board, and then you'll put your ship into the starting port, and then you're pretty much ready to play the game. There's also some other things you're going to need to put out on the board to set things up. Each port on the board is going to have one space that will have a ship improvement token, and then another space that will have a goods token. The goods tokens are put on the board face up to just show what goods are currently in demand for that port, which is important. You know, like I said, if you sell three cargo cards in the in-demand port, then you'll get a glory point for that. Then there's a face-down one for ship improvements, where when you go into that port, it'll turn those over, and that's basically a way you can upgrade your ship in that particular port. That's revealed when you go into the port. Then you're pretty much ready to start the game. On your turn, you're going to be able to do a bunch of different things, actually. So these turns can be a little bit long, I guess. But the first thing that you're going to do is the start player is going to turn over an event card. And that event, more often than not, is going to put some sort of an NPC ship on the board. And these may be either naval ships or pirate ships. And so they will go on the board, and then there's going to be specific ways that they will move around the board. When later event cards come up, it might cause those ships to move and kind of patrol. But those ships are going to break those movement rules if they happen to be looking for a particular player. We'll talk about that in a second, about how a ship might start looking for you. After that event card is drawn, then each player is going to take their actions for the turn. And you get three actions on your turn, and you have several things that you can do. You can move, and moving is just moving from one sea space to an adjacent sea space. There are 17 sea spaces in the game. It's very beautifully laid out, very easy to see.
Or into or out of a port.
Or into or out of a port, yep. And that's actually the very first time we played the game. We played that rule wrong, and it completely changed the entire game. Because we thought that you didn't have to spend a movement point to move from port to the sea or from sea to the port, but you do. Then if you happen to go into a port, then you can do port actions, which there's a whole list of like six things that you can do in port. So you can do things like sell goods. If you have those cargo cards, you can sell them at the port. You can then buy goods. You can visit the shipyard to upgrade your ship. You can recruit more crew. You can also do something called acquiring a rumor. This is another way that you could possibly get a glory point. Basically, you'll do a special roll of the dice, and if you're able to pass that roll, you'll get a rumor card. The rumor card is almost kind of like a mini mission. You have to go to a particular location and roll some dice, and if the result is favorable, then you will get a glory point, and then that rumor card will usually generate some kind of a benefit for you. So there's that, and then you can also claim a mission. So another kind of card in the game are called mission cards, where as you go around on the board, the game starts off with two of these on the board, where when you go to that location, you can claim that card, and then again, you're going to go to another location, do a specific thing, do whatever the card says. And then if you complete the mission, you get a glory point. And then you can also stash gold if you happen to be in your own home port. You can stash as much gold as you want. But once the gold goes into your stash, you can't pull it back out again. So you want to make sure not to stash all of your gold, or then you won't have any money to buy any goods.
No walking around money. Right. Sailing around money.
Although if all you're doing is going and plundering ships and attacking like a dirty pirate, then you might not need any money.
Which you would never do.
No, why would you do that?
It's funny because I've seen this parallel drawn. It's the Marauder path is almost your Ameritrash gamer, you know, because you're sailing and attacking, rolling outside, and the merchant is very kind of organized. You're going here, you're getting things,
selling things. Yeah,
but you know, and I don't even mean that as a joke. It's kind of nice because it can, you know, I'm trying to get more to that middle of the road, but you have the people who are really Ameritrash or really Euro, and you can bring them together and play it. I think that's pretty neat.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and if you keep your nose clean in the game and don't make anybody mad, meaning like the other naval ships and everything, mm-hmm. you can keep that game up for quite a while.
Yeah.
Until one of the other players comes in and tries to sink your ship.
Yeah.
The third thing that you can do, so those are all the port actions if you're in port. The third thing that you could do in your turn, if you happen to be in a sea zone, is you can scout. And when the board is laid out, there are these little circular tokens called merchant tokens, and they're laid face down in each of the sea zones. And on the back of them, they just have a particular country's marker. And so that's going to tell you what kind of merchant ships are in that particular sea zone. So if you happen to be in a sea zone that has one of those merchant tokens or has another ship in it, then you can scout for that ship. And the scouting basically means that you're going to roll a scouting skill. Each of your captain cards has these different stats on it. And the stats basically are the number of dice that you're going to roll to do a check of that skill. Anybody who's played like Arkham Horror will sort of recognize this mechanic, and is that if you roll a 5 or a 6, that's considered a success. And so if you have a scouting skill of a 3 and then you roll 3 dice, then as long as one of those comes up as a 5 or a 6, then that's considered you passing the roll. This is made even easier in this game because the 5s and the 6s aren't 5s and 6s at all. They're skull and crossbones. So it's real nice. Easy to see whether you pass a roll or not, because you just roll the dice. If you see a skull and crossbones, then you're good.
I'd like to see a they have these dice that are kind of like bone dice. You know, they're not, I don't think they're real bone, but they're shaped like almost like knuckle bone dice. And that would have been neat to see. But no, the theme's really neat. At first, I didn't understand why the pips were on there. You know, I thought it would just be, you know, skull and crossbones are nothing. But as John will get into, the pips are important.
Oh, yeah, when you get into the combat part of it. Once you scout, then if you happen to find the ship that you're looking for, if you find that merchant ship, then you can choose whether you're going to raid the merchant ship or not. Now, a good upstanding merchant would never raid another merchant ship.
You do that Harley Davidson kind of wave. You know, you put the hand up and you ride by.
Yeah. So you can choose not to do that if you don't want to, but you can also perform a merchant raid to try to raid a ship. Now, there's no ships, you know, merchant ships miniatures on the board, but the mechanic for this is that you're actually going to take you're going to take three of these cargo cards and lay them out. The cargo cards serve kind of a dual purpose. The upper part of the card shows an actual piece of cargo, like sugar cane or cocoa beans or something like that. The bottom part is what you're using when you resolve merchant raid combat. So you're going to turn over three cards, and they're going to have a various number of things on them. They'll have like hits to particular parts of your ship, like there'll be a little explosion symbol, and it'll say cannons, which means it hits your cannon for 1 point. Or it might have a little icon on it with a ship with an arrow, and that's an escape icon. So you're going to turn these over, and you basically kind of assess what happened to the battle, and you know, to see what happened to your ship, which things got hit, and if there's ever a number of escape icons that is greater than your ship's maneuverability, then that means that the merchant ship got away from you. But there's a modifier that you can do to this. There's a stat on your captain's card called the seamanship stat. And so you're going to roll your seamanship stat, and for every success that you get on the dice, you can either add a card to this tableau you have in front of you, you can remove a card, or you can exchange a card. You know, draw one and then exchange it with one. So this allows you to sort of massage the outcome of what happened there.
Massage,
yeah,
very nice.
The other thing that's going to be on the cards is a number, which is a number of gold. And so if it turns out that at the end of all the resolution of the merchant raid that your ship is still intact and that none of its locations have been destroyed, and the other ship didn't escape, then it's successful. And that means that you're going to add up all the numbers on the cards, and that's going to be the amount of gold that you get. And then you're also going to get the cargo cards, and depending on the size of the cargo hold of your ship, then you can keep some of those cards. So that's sort of just plundering the ship there. If you happen to do a merchant raid with 12 or more gold, then that is also worth a glory point. And so that's another way that you can get points in the game. If whenever you get a glory point, you're also going to get a glory card. I forgot to mention this. Did you actually start off with one of these at the beginning of the game? And then every time you get a glory point, you're going to get a glory card, which these are just basically rule breakers in the games, little interrupts and things that you can play that might help you in certain situations, re-rolling dice or getting to do things out of order, that kind of stuff. So you get a little bit more powerful as the game goes along, as you have more things at your disposal.
Yeah, if you get someone who's maybe starting to run away with the glory points, you may want to check them because they're also getting these cards that, you know, if they get the right ones, they could just kind of run away with the whole game.
Right. Now, a downside to doing a merchant raid, or I didn't mention this, but you know, if you attack another ship or a naval ship, which that's a completely different animal that we'll talk about in a second. If you do any of those things, then you're going to draw the ire of a particular nation. And so therefore, you will get a bounty put on your head. So if you had a Dutch merchant ship, and you did a merchant raid with them, well, now you have a Dutch bounty on your head.
Successful or
not, yeah. And so if you, you'll take a little flag icon there and put it onto your player board to show that you have a Dutch bounty. Well, this is a bad thing for you because it basically means that any naval ships that are that have been placed on the board via those event cards are now, when they have to move, they're going to start moving towards you instead of just moving in the direction that it says on the cards. There's basically what's called a hunt priority. And so like the naval ships are going to start hunting for ships based upon this particular priority. It'll start off with captains that have a bounty from their particular nation. And then after that, if there's nobody in that category, then it will look for captains that have any bounties on their heads. And then after that, there's a situation where two nations might be at war. They might look for captains of the enemy nationality. In the same way, pirates are going to be looking for non-pirates with gold or cargo or things like that on board their ship. The thing is, and this is the good thing, I guess, is that if you become a pirate, and the definition in this game is that anytime you have a bounty on you, you're a pirate.
Makes sense.
The pirates will not look for you then, because you're a pirate. So now you're friends with now you're doing the Harley Davidson wave to the other pirate ships, but all the other ships are after you. So it makes for some interesting decisions, because you know you can choose to be the good merchant and everything, or if you start to make these riskier choices of being a pirate and attacking things, you'll get bigger reward, but now you have a little bit more of a dangerous situation that you're in. So the game will continue. You know, those are the three things you can do in your turn, and that will just continue around basically until someone gets 10 glory points. One thing to mention now is the combat in the game, and it's a little bit complex, but it's not really too hard. After you do it a little while, it becomes pretty intuitive. In that you basically have just a few actions that you can do during combat. And you're going to start off by sort of declaring what you're doing. So if you attack an NPC ship, then another player is going to grab the dice for and play that particular role. And so you're going to sort of declare what you want to do. You can shoot, or you can flee if you wanted to flee, or you can choose to try to board the other ship. Once each player has decided what the thing they want to do, then you're going to roll a skill called seamanship. And then whoever has gotten the best number of successes on seamanship is going to be able to perform their action first. And so this is where the extra pips on the dice come into play, is because if you roll and you tie on the number of successes, then you're going to add up all the pips on the other dice, and then that's going to determine who the winner is. That's sort of the tiebreaker. And there's some other bonuses and things that you might get in this situation. But then after that, then you know whoever has won is going to, you know, inflict hits on the other ships if they do a shoot action. Or if they're successful with a boarding action, then the whole combat completely ends and you move on to crew combat, which is a different sort of die rolls and comparing different things. You're trying to reduce the person's crew. So it's a very logical progression, but there's a few steps involved in it. But anyway, so... and then, of course, if you defeat another ship, then you get to plunder their ship and take all of their stuff. If you happen to die, then you kind of get a reset on the game. You get a new captain. You get a new starting ship. You lose all your stuff except for the gold that you stashed. And you can sort of continue the game from there. You don't lose any of your glory points, which is a nice thing.
Yeah.
So the game just continues until you reach that endpoint. And that is the whole deal there. Game, like I said, takes about 45 minutes per player, especially after you've learned the rules and know it pretty well. But I've talked long enough, so Cody, why don't you give me... first of all, will you tell the listeners kind of how we do our reviews, and we haven't done a long review in a while, and how our buy, try, or deny system works?
Sure. We rate games with our buy, try, or deny system. What we do is John and I are going to give you our buy points for the game, which... tells you the reasons of the game that you should go out and buy it right now. We'll give try points, which may give some people pause and just iffy issues that some people may like, some people may not. And then we'll give you deny issues for reasons we think you should not play this game, or bad things in general about the game. So that's pretty much it. So to start...
Okay. You want me to... that was an expert... reading of the rules. Why don't you go ahead and start and give us your buy points for this game?
Well, as John mentioned, the game is just dripping with theme. I mean, all the components and the artwork and everything top to bottom is really well done. The reference sheets, it's one of those kind of like full-size square ones, you know, think Small World, that kind of size. And just as helpful. I mean, everything, once you get the rules, is on that sheet and you're good to go. It's really nice. It's got a good... I like that there are multiple paths to victory. I think that's another plus. And it's just a good experience. You really feel like you're getting into the theme. You know, you really feel like you're engaging in piracy or engaging in trading, and it just sucks you in. Like I mentioned earlier, a lot like that Sid Meier's Pirates video game. So it's a really a lot of fun, and the theme just carries on from the artwork to the gameplay, and it's just a real solid experience all around. That's the best way I can describe it. What would you say, John?
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. A real solid experience. I thought the artwork and the components, like I said, are just outstanding. It's so much fun. You really, especially with a three-dimensional little treasure chest there, you just feel like you're in this, you know, piratey situation. I almost wish the game had come with eye patches and hats, mm-hmm. you know, and plastic hooks or something, because it's just that much fun as far as that goes. And you heard Cody and I sort of going back and forth the whole thing about, being a law-abiding merchant versus a you do that during the game. We found ourselves doing that quite a lot of, are you really going to attack me? Well, that's not something that a good merchant would do, you know? And there's a great amount of tension in the game, which I enjoy, this sort of risk-reward play here, where if you decide to do something that's risky, you know, doing those piratey sort of actions, that you get a higher reward, but there's much more risk. Cody got into a real bad scrape when he went full-on pirate, and he just had all these naval ships after him. But there were some cool cards and extra things, special things that he was able to do to sort of get out of tough spots there. I really like that. I feel like every game is going to be a little bit different. I just have found that a lot of games that I buy, I'll get them to the table and I'm like, oh, that was a good game, you know. And if I don't get to the table in the next month, that's okay. It was a good game. This game we've pulled out like three times in the first couple of weeks, and I'm finding myself wanting to play it more and more, and it's just a really satisfying experience.
Yep.
What about try points?
I would say that a lot of the scuttlebutt about this game is that the merchants have it easier, and I really think they do. I think if you completely stick to a merchant path of just trading and not really getting any bounties, I think it's an easier path to victory. I don't know how balanced it is. It's much more fun to be a pirate, and there have been some tweaks and house ruling stuff, and I think even the designers of the game have come out with variants that balance it a little more. But out of the box, it is a lot easier to be a merchant and a lot easier to get to that 10 glory. So I'd say that. And then the other thing is that your first game may take a while, especially if you're all newbies, just because the rules are intuitive once you get it. But for this game especially, I think the initial learning curve's a little steep, and then it levels off. There's kind of an aha moment, and you get how it goes, and then it's pretty easy. So just a word of warning there.
That's a really good way of putting it, because there are some games that I play that you learn the rules and it's a steep learning curve, and then you just never feel like you know the rules. You feel like even in your fifth play of the game, you're still pulling the rule book out every 5 minutes. With this game, we played it going on our third time now, and we've still had to pull the rule book out for some slight things. But I feel like by our next couple of plays, we won't have to pull the rule book out. I keep saying rule book. What's my problem? Rule book out. And and I think everybody will have it down. It's very intuitive. That's a positive thing. But it is long, and I think that's
now see, if I think if you have if everyone's played it a few times, you could get down to 30 minutes a player, I think.
I think you're probably right. Yeah. But it's still it's a rich experience, for better or for worse.
Yeah, and that's something, when we first played it, it was a lot crunchier and a lot meatier than I thought it was going to be, just based on box art and pictures I'd seen of it. Yeah. So
I thought you didn't like it at first. Kept looking over at you, and you look pretty miserable.
I was just taking it in.
Yeah, you were.
just be warned. I mean, I don't even warn, but it's a little meatier than you might think. Your first play is definitely going to be a 3+ hour affair.
Yeah,
and then it'll get faster after that. So just a heads up.
Yeah, I agree. This is one other thing I wanted to say, is that it's such a good mix, though, I think, of luck that you can sort of manage. You can sort of manage the luck in the game. That there's lots of die rolls, but you don't feel like you're on autopilot on the game. Game's happening to you. I mean, there's things that you can do. There's just a good tension that exists there. That's the whole thing about being a merchant or being a marauder. I'm not sure. I have read that if you go with the rule that you can only use three glory points using stashed money instead of five, mm-hmm. that tends to help a little bit with that problem. It also might make the game a little bit longer, because you have to actually earn those points on the sea a little bit more.
That leads into my only deny point for the game.
Go for it.
Is that the end game can be very anticlimactic, because it's pretty much once you have your 10 glory, five of which you can get through storing 10 gold apiece, you just kind of reveal and that's it. Yeah. So pretty much all the games we played, you know, someone stashes that last gold, or they get another glory somehow, and then like, oh yeah, I've got 50 gold, I win.
Yeah,
it's just kind of oh.
Yeah, I think half the glory being allowed for stashed money is too much.
Yeah,
Or you could, and if you thought it was too long, you could probably scale the game on based on the number of glory points. I think 10 is just kind of an arbitrary number just mm-hmm. for length. I mean, you could make it less or more.
Yeah, I mean, my problem's more with it's just anticlimactic how you reveal it, and you're just, oh, you know.
So you go back to your port and open it, and I open up my treasure box and win!
Yeah. One variant I've seen is that you don't get a glory card for trading three goods.
Oh, right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so you just don't get... That balances a little bit. So, in-game, a little anticlimactic for my taste. Did okay. you have any deny points?
I don't think that I did. I really, really liked it. And mm-hmm. I love games that just make sense. Like, there weren't any mechanics in the game that were thrown in for the game's sake that didn't also fit with the theme. And I just thought that was really cool. So even the dice rolls and the different stats that you have to roll, like, you know, you roll seamanship for when you're in combat, that totally makes sense. When you're trying to recruit crew, you're rolling leadership. Well, that totally makes sense. And then it's like, if you fail your leadership roll to recruit crew, you can still buy crew, you know, with your money, but with leadership, you can actually draw them in. It just really makes a lot of sense. So you can tell that this was pretty well play tested, even though it's got a couple little picky details that people are questioning, but really well done.
Yeah. The game's a definite buy from both of us.
Yep.
So we would recommend you hit up your friendly professional game store or Myriad Games and pick up Merchants and Marauders today.
Yar. Well, that just about wraps up episode 58 of Game On with Cody and John. Another great episode.
I thought so.
Yeah, it was pretty good. And we'd like to tell you about all the great ways that you can contact us. Wayne will be giving you the big list on the way out, but I want to mention that you can always reach us at the Game On Inbox.
That's gameoninbox@gmail.com.
That's right. We've got a guild on boardgamegeek.com where we've got a discussion about the show and things like that. You can always check us out at gameonpodcast.com. And hey, don't want to forget the donate button. We've got the donate button there on the website. If you ever wanted to support the show, we do appreciate any support you guys give us. Helps things keep running, you know, help us to go another 58 episodes of bringing you great Game On content. So just feel free to click on that and PayPal to your heart's delight. Join us in 2 weeks where we're going to be talking about I don't even know.
All sorts of good stuff.
All sorts of good gaming stuff. We're going to be still bundled up here in the Indiana winter. But hey, until next time.
Game On.
This episode of Game On is sponsored by Myriad Games on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. If you'd like to contact Cody and John, send them an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com or leave a voicemail at 413-8-GAME-ON. For more content, check out our website at gameonpodcast.com. Join our guild on boardgamegeek.com and connect with other fans of the show. Become a fan of our show on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Game On Podcast. Game On with Cody and John is a proud member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. Check out other great shows on pulpgamer.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, Game On!